but next Monday you'll be ready to start actually doing classical mechanics using this geometrical language. So I will just give you today, you know, a very, very brief glimpse to what happens in Lagrangian mechanics. But actually the description is not that nice as in Hamiltonian mechanics. So I will do this very, very quickly in 15 minutes. And it's, you know, just to tell you that you can do Lagrangian mechanics in this geometrical language as well. And then I will review basically what you know about Hamiltonian mechanics. So that's the plan for today's lecture. And then we'll be ready to actually start recasting this Hamiltonian picture into this geometrical formulation. So really try to learn this differential geometry because it will be useful next week. So the basic idea of Lagrangian mechanics is that usually Lagrangian mechanics is done on configuration space, which is the space of your generalized coordinates, and that has n degrees of freedom. And so what this configuration space describes is like for each time I describe a photo of the system. So in particular, the trajectory which corresponds to time evolution, so each point on my manifold corresponds to one configuration of the system at a given time, and then time evolution corresponds to a curve on my manifold, and let's denote this curve by this delta of t. So now what people do is that they extend this phase this configuration space to something much bigger, which is now twice as big, and it's called phase space. In case of Lagrangian mechanics, it will be velocity phase space. In case of Hamiltonian mechanics, it will be just called phase space or real phase space. And instead of velocities, you will have momenta there, okay? So anyway, so velocity phase space consists of generalized coordinates and generalized velocities here. The dimension is 2n. And so if I specify all of these, I actually know the physical state of the system because I not only know what my position is, but I also know what my velocity is. So I have the complete description there is about the system. And so there'll be also curves in this velocity phase space, and I'll denote them by gamma. And this is basically what we are after. So you want to describe, well, we would find some differential equation which actually tells me what these gammas are. Or if you are not interested in the full description, if you are not interested in the velocities, but you are only interested in the trajectory, then we will project these gammas to this configuration space. So just remember, I will denote configuration space by C, and because now we include not only the points, but also the velocities, in other words, the tangent vectors to these curves, so we live actually on a tangent space. So this is actually a tangent bundle of a configuration space. Okay, so here's the example of a tangent bundle of the configuration space for a mathematical pendulum. So we now have two coordinates. We have the angle phi, and then we have the corresponding velocity omega. And the physical motion of the pendulum is described by this trajectory gamma, which is an integral curve of some vector field x. Okay, so there's one-to-one correspondence between integral curves and the vector field x. So in other words, if I can find x, I know these trajectories gamma. Okay, if I don't care about the velocities, I can use this canonical projection to project these curves gamma into these curves delta, just forgetting what the velocities are, basically. Okay, and so the aim is really to find, you know, how do I find this vector field x? Okay. Questions to this description? So, of course, the dynamics is specified by Lagrangian. So, Lagrangian L is a function which goes from this velocity. So, it's a function of Q and Q dot. So, it's a function from tangent bundle to a real number. Right? And so once I specify this L, I should be able to find this vector field X and these gammas and these deltas and so on. So X is called dynamical vector field. And because it's a vector field, it lives on a tangent space of my manifold. But I want this vector field to live in a tangent space of my velocity phase space, right? So it actually belongs to the tangent space of my phase space. Okay. So TC is my manifold now. It's my phase space. But now I have to live on a tangent space of that. Okay. And so determines, if I can find it, it determines integral curves gamma. They will live on a, yes?
Shortening time in this description, do you have to add a dimension to your configuration space? Yeah. But then you also have a conjugate variable in.
I'll do that next week, don't worry. I'll promote time to another coordinate. Gamma t. It's a good point. And so gamma t actually lives in my phase space, right? So on tc. And of course, the trajectory. So trajectory delta is just a canonical projection of these integral curves. Okay. So now, just a few more words about this dynamical vector field. It's a very special field. It's not an arbitrary vector field, which you can define on this tangent of configuration space, but it's a very special one. So first of all, it generates integral curves. So field generating integral curves. So x is t over dt, right? So it's some kind of evolution along this trajectory. And then for any integral curve, you know that its components actually are derivatives along that direction, along my gamma of the coordinates, right? So it has to have the form. So my coordinates are these coordinates now. It's q and q dot. So the components of the vector fields are with dq1 over dt and so on, and dq dot 1 over dt. Okay, so dqi over dt, and then d over dqi, and then the other one is dq dot I over dt, d over dq dot I. Right, so this must be the case because it's just a. This plus that are my basis vectors, and this is just that it's tangent thing. However, we have an extra condition here. Extra condition that tangent to my trajectory to delta t must be the physical velocity of the system, right? Is a velocity. So in other words, this thing here actually must be our generalized velocity, right? So that's our condition. So dqi t over dt actually must be the same thing as qi dot. So just to stress again what's going on. So this thing is the generalized velocity, and it's my coordinate basically on the phase space, right? And this thing is just saying the tangent to my curve delta, so this is the tangent thing, the components of my vector must coincide with this velocity. Okay, so that's a condition. It looks very intuitive, right? dq over dt is q dot. Well, that's fine. So the notation actually is not that bad. Okay. So in other words, it means that my full vector field So X now takes a form qi dot, d over dqi. And then, of course, this thing here is something relatively complicated, which you can get from Euler-Lagrange equations, right? But in general, the components of a vector, they depend on coordinates. So in other words, they will depend on, this will be some function of qi and qi dot. Let's call this function w. So wi, which is function of qj and qj dot, that these are my coordinates on the phase space, and then d over dq dot I. Okay, so this will be my vector field. As I said, you can determine what this w is from Euler-Lagrange equations, but it's actually relatively complicated and it's not very useful, so let's not do it. But you see that this vector field actually is very, very special, because any tangent vector field will have components which are arbitrary functions of q and q dot, and another function which is function of q and q dot. So this one is special. It has actually here just q dot. So this is a very special field. So this is actually special, and there is a classification of fields depending on how they look like. And because this one has only Q dot here, it's a very special field. It has its own name, and people are happy when they see this vector field. Is this clear? So finally, let me just tell you, definition first. We call a Lagrange one form. Lagrange one form definition is that it equals to theta, and so for given L, let's call it theta L. You will just remember L. So dL over dq dot I dqi. Okay, so for a given Lagrangian, I just define the following one form living on my phase space. Okay, these are its components. This is the basis. You see that I am missing the other part. I am missing dqi dot. So this is a very special form living in the phase space. It basically lives only in half of the phase space, if you want. Okay, so that's a definition. So now theorem, which actually tells me how to solve my problem, right? How to find x. So the physical state of the Lagrangian system of the Lagrangian system with Lagrangian L is determined from integral curves of vector field X, so from X, if you want, from X, I tried to explain how you do that, which is given by, and now here is your differential equations, which actually give you what you need to do. It's a Lie derivative with respect to this vector field X of this one form theta. It has to be equal to something, and the something has to depend on L, so it's actually equal to dL. So Lie derivative of a one form is a one form, L is a function, d of L is a one form, right? So this is your equation of motion. And you want to solve it for X. So theta is something I know, right? So given L, so L is given to me, right? So given L, I can find theta. It's just given here. So I can also find this thing here. So the only unknown which I'm solving for is this dynamical vector field X. Okay. So let me prove that. And the proof is simple, so that's why I do that. Okay, so proof. So you want to show that this equation here is actually equivalent to your Euler Lagrange equations, right? If it's equivalent to your Euler Lagrange equations, then I'm just recasting the old, you know, something I know just to a new formulation. So is it equivalent to Euler Lagrange equation? So let us calculate what is left hand side and let us see where it leads to. Okay, so Lx of theta. Okay, so now theta, I have to use this definition here. So it consists of two parts. So let's just write it there. Lx of dl over dq dot I dqi. This is what it is, just from my definition. So now you know that the Lie derivative is proper derivative, so it satisfies Leibniz rule. So I can first differentiate this guy and leave this one, and then I differentiate this guy and leave this one. Okay. So let's first write this one, Lx dl over dq dot I, and then dqi plus dl over dq dot I Lx of dqi. And I know the mistake I made. I didn't remind you the Cartan's lemma. But anyway, okay. So now what is this guy here? It's a Lie derivative of the components, if you want. So it's a Lie derivative of a function, right? So this is a function. So I can just define the function. And you remember from yesterday's tutorial that Lie derivative of a function is just a vector field acting on that function, right? So, but my vector field actually is this d over dt. So what it is actually d over dt acting on this thing, right? So this equals to d over dt dl over dq dot I. Now I use my Euler Lagrange equation. So this is, of course, dl over dqi. Okay, so let's. So the first term is simple. So in the end, the first term is just dl over dqi, dqi. Okay. Now, what about the other term? So let me just remind you the Cartan's lemma, especially acting on function. So what was it? So it was Lx acting on t of f was the same as d Lx acting on f. So just find your notes from yesterday, and this was the Cartan's lemma, valid for anything. So now let's apply it here. So I have Lx acting on d of qi is equal to d of Lx on qi, right? So now again, I have a Lie derivative acting on a function, okay, which is d over dt of that function. So I have d, and okay, and d over dt of that function is from here. It's qi dot, right? So dqi over dt is qi dot. So the whole thing here is d of qi dot. Okay. So we have established that the whole thing equals to dl over dqi dqi from the first term and dl over dq dot I, dq dot I. What is this equal to? So you prove that really, with using this definition of theta, the whole thing is equivalent to Euler Lagrange equations, if you want. So you have this very nice, so instead of, so you can, you know, go home now and say, well, this is my Euler Lagrange equation. And then explain to everybody, to your grandma or whatever. Okay. So you can develop the whole Lagrangian formalism from here, but let's not do it. Let's rather return back to something you know, which is the Hamiltonian picture, and let's do it more properly there. So I'll stop here the Lagrangian formulation, and let's do. But as I said, you can basically whatever you do in Hamiltonian picture, you can also do in the Lagrangian picture, but the Hamiltonian is sort of nicer. So let's go there now. So this completes the Lagrangian section, if you want. Yes?
Maybe a stupid question, but does this introduce any advantage for solving problems?
Of course not. Never.
No. But it gives you some geometrical intuition what's going on. And it will be particularly useful, for example, for the when we will discuss Hamilton-Jacobi theory, is that you will see how beautiful it is actually what's going on. But yeah, everything is, you know, once you don't write that many indices, it's simpler. You are not likely to make many mistakes, and actually, yeah, I think it's nicer probably. But of course, it's just recasting whatever you know. It's not that you would gain something, but you can use differential form language, and so the calculations are maybe a little bit easier, but it depends on what you are used to. But it, you know, it doesn't mean that you introduce new physics. No, you haven't. Yes?
We write the formula for the Lagrange equations in the differential geometry language, but I'm not really getting like better intuition.
Okay, you will get it in the Hamiltonian picture. I'm just, you know, I want to do this very briefly. Because it's not that nice, but in Hamiltonian picture you will see how beautiful actually it is. Okay, so wait till next week if you can. Okay, so chapter 2, Hamiltonian mechanics. And so this will be a review, I hope, for you. So Hamilton's canonical equations and so basically going from a Lagrangian picture to a Hamiltonian one, the first thing you do is that you introduce generalized momentum, so canonical momentum. Which is dl over dq dot j. So again, you can introduce a configuration space and the phase space. Now, there's no velocity, word velocity, it's just phase space. And so the phase space now is the real space one, the real one, phase space. Well, now consists of not velocities, but the momenta, right? And again, it will have dimension 2n, and contrary to configuration space, it will describe the physical state of the system, right? Because if I know the position and the momentum, I know everything about the system. Okay. Next step is to introduce the Hamiltonian. Which will be something which is given by so-called Legendre transformation. So by the way, you can develop Hamiltonian picture without using Lagrangian at all. So you can just start postulating I have a Hamiltonian. That's usually the better way. But if you for some reason, which is sometimes the case, are given the Lagrangian, you can go to the Hamiltonian picture if some nice conditions are satisfied. And then the two pictures are related by this Legendre transform. of Lagrangian. And the formula is, of course, well known. So now I want Hamiltonian to be function of Q and P. And this is given by PI or PJ Q dot J minus L. And of course, L is a function of Q and Q dot. And I have Q dot here, but in the end, I don't want any Q dot there, so I want just Q and P. So I have to actually invert the relation P to solve for Q dot in terms of Q and P. Okay, so where Q J dot is a function of QI, PI, and T through my relation P. So I have to be able to invert this relation and solve it for Q dot in terms of Q and P. And it's not always possible and causes problems, and especially if you have constraints, you cannot do it and so on. So there may be a problem. That's why it's not always straightforward to go from Lagrangian to Hamiltonian picture. Okay. But anyway, so this is the formula. So never forget to plug Q dot in terms of Q and P. Yes?
The symmetry that we had in the Lagrangian picture when we add total derivative to L, if I do that and then I find the Hamiltonian from this modified Lagrangian, is it still going to be a valid equation of motion?
We will get to that in a minute. So wait, 20 minutes. Yes. So you had extra gauge freedom, if you want, in Lagrangian. You have even bigger gauge freedom in Hamiltonian. And that's called canonical transformations. Okay. So now, theorem. It's not enough space. Let's write it somewhere else. It's an important theorem. So theorem, the system of n Euler Lagrange equations remember the Euler Lagrange equations are second order equations in time, right? That's what you established, is equivalent to the system of now 2n Hamilton equations which are now first order. In time. And so these are pj dot equals to minus dh over dq j. That's the first set. And the other set is qj dot equals to dh over dpj. So these are Hamilton's equations. So again, you may argue that we haven't gained much. We just traded n second order equations for 2n first order equations. It's just a different description of the same thing at this point, if you want. So now, how you prove this theorem is either you explicitly calculate what dH over dPJ is using your definition of what you mean by H, and then you use Euler Lagrange equations to show that indeed it will be given by QJ dot, which is a straightforward way, and if you want, you can do it. Or you can invoke again the variational principle. So that's beautiful. And I don't know if everybody's seen that. So because people usually just do it for Lagrangian mechanics. So let me do it for Hamiltonian mechanics. So you remember that your so the variational principle. That means that my action has to be stationary, right? This is again the normal delta. It's not the delta tilde. I'm just changing the trajectories if you want. In this case, it will be trajectories in Q and P. Okay. So that's delta. So my action is still LDT, right? So now I have to actually write L as PQ dot minus H. So it's PI Q dot I minus H dt. That's still my L, right? So now I actually have to calculate the variation. So the and I will have two independent things. I can vary p's and I can vary q's, right? So p's and q's are my variables now. Okay, so let's do it. So the first term, so it's integral from 1 to 2. Then let me, okay, first term, let me vary q. Okay, so I'll have pi. And then I will have delta q dot I. Okay. But of course, delta and derivative, time derivative commute. So I can equally write this as d over dt delta qi, right? So that's first term. Then I have the other one plus q dot I delta pi. Okay. And then the Hamiltonian is a function of q and p. Okay, so it's minus dh over dqi delta qi minus dh over dpi delta pi. By the way, notice that I always write index for p down and index for q up. It's just to remind you that these are sort of different objects, but actually they live in a different space as well. So, so these guys will be forms, and q's are just coordinates on your manifold if you want. Okay, so this is what it is, dt. Okay, so now again, what you want to do is that you want to integrate by parts in the same way as you did. So in the end, you want to write some things times delta q plus some things times delta p. Okay, so I will have to integrate this one by parts, so, which means I pick up a boundary term, pi delta qi 2 and 1. Okay, and then plus the integral 1 to 2. And let me collect everything which stands by delta pi. Delta pi. So it's q dot I. Q dot I. And then minus dh over dpi. And then let me put a minus there. Doesn't matter. Delta qi. We minus pi dot, so pi dot, and then plus dh over dqi. And the whole thing is still dt. Okay. And so, of course, now we want that this is equal to zero. Of course, you still have fixed endpoints, so the boundaries actually are gone. So this is gone. So the only way how you can manage that this is actually a zero for any variation of P and Q is that this guy vanishes separately and this guy vanishes separately, which is your Hamilton's equation. Okay, so that's the variational principle in the Hamiltonian language, if you want. And it's, you know, equally beautiful, maybe even more beautiful than in the Lagrangian picture. So now a trivial observer, yes?
Momentum, is it really independent of dqi? Do you take dpi and dqi to be really independent? Because they come from the same Lagrangian and in principle, they depend one on each other.
Well, you extended your space. You are not living on the configuration space anymore. You are living in your phase space. And so you need 2n independent coordinates. And you are assuming you can take them to be qi's and pi's. So it's basically like really I'm describing my mechanics in a bigger space. And yeah.
Sure, but then in this case then you would only have the canonical the PIs to be the canonical momenta if you are on a shell, right? Otherwise they would be dependent on each other.
Well of course in the end the PIs are related to QI dots through this P. So I have sort of, if you want, that's an additional constraint, if you want. Yeah, I still have that expression P, which really connects P's to Q's, if you want.
So in principle, we should not put that like as some Lagrange multiplier.
The whole point is that you did the transformation so that you can sort of, well, you still have to remember that, but you treat it as independent, Q and P's. On a phase space, where you need 2n degrees of freedom. Yeah. So just a trivial remark is that if you calculate what dh over dt is, okay, and then so it's and you use these what dh over dq and dh over dp is, and it's p dot and q dot, then the two terms actually cancel, and the only thing which remains is the dh over dt partial derivative. So what it means is, so if h is not a function of t explicitly, then h is conserved in your energy. So h, q, and p is a constant, which is the energy of the system. So, by the way, the same Legendre transformation is used in thermodynamics, and there's a small section in the notes if you want to take a look at that. So it's not only useful for going from Lagrangian to Hamiltonian picture, but it's much more useful for other things. But I don't have time to do that now. So let's discuss very, very important concept of Hamiltonian dynamics, and that's the Poisson brackets. Who has seen Poisson brackets before? Almost everybody, that's good. So I'll be mostly review. So definition. So let F and G be two phase space functions. Then you will say that their Poisson bracket is a new function on the phase space. And it's defined as follows. So it's really denoted by a bracket. So you have two functions, f and g, and you want to assign a new function. And this is given by df. You first differentiate f with respect to q. So f and g are functions of q and p. So df over dqi, and then you take the other one, dpi. Again, there is an Einstein summation convention. So if you have more, then you sum over them. And then you subtract, and then you swap them. So it's dg over dqi and df over dpi. Okay, so this is the definition. And maybe let me stress that, well, this is the only thing which you usually see. Let me say that this is a canonical Poisson bracket. Canonical, if you want. So it's a canonical Poisson bracket. You will see another Poisson bracket next week. And only in very, very special case, it will take this form. Okay. So now there is very many nice properties which these brackets satisfy. So first, you can calculate from this definition. So let me just use this as a definition, and let me just infer more general properties. So fundamental brackets and that's basically if I take f and g to be special things, so q and p. Okay, so if I take qi and pj, what do I get? So just, you know, plug it here, and it gives you delta ij. And if I have qi and qj, what do I get? Zero. And the same thing if I get pi and pj. So this is called fundamental brackets. So by the way, if you have taken a course on quantum mechanics, you probably started from here. And he said, well, if I want quantum world, I can start with a classical world and do some very, very strange procedure, which may sometimes work and sometimes it doesn't. But basically, so in quantum mechanics, what you do is that you say, well, I start with classical mechanics, so I have qi and pi, and I promote these to operators, right? So I promote them to qi dot, qi hat, and pi hat. So these are operators. And then you take these fundamental Poisson brackets as a guiding principle how to do quantum mechanics. And so the only thing that you do is that you replace the Poisson bracket with the commutator. And then you impose these things equally here. So you say that the commutator of the operators of qi and qj is equal to 0 and pi and pj is equal to 0. But you have a non-trivial commutator between qi and pi hat. And it will be something like delta ij, but you stick in also your Planck constant. Okay? So these fundamental brackets will play a very important role in quantum mechanics, but also in quantum field theory. That's how people actually quantize fields as well. So they just find generalized, if you want, generalized coordinates and generalized momenta, and they impose these fundamental brackets. And then so this is a transition to quantum mechanics. And you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you have to do more work. But that's, of course, you cannot derive quantum mechanics from a classical one, right? Something more fundamental. What you can do is that you can take a classical limit of quantum mechanics, but there's no guiding principle how to invent quantum mechanics from a classical one. But this usually works. Okay. So that was the first property, that we can calculate the fundamental brackets. Second one is that the brackets as defined are antisymmetric. Which means that f and g, because of that minus sign, is minus g and f. They are linear. Meaning alpha f plus beta g acting on h is just alpha f of h plus beta g of h. Just comes from the fact that it's a derivative. This is for alpha, beta, real numbers. Leibniz rule is also true. If I have product of two functions, again, I differentiate one, and then I differentiate the second one. So this is equal to f gh plus fh g. On purpose, I wrote g on the right-hand side. It'll be true also if you have matrices, okay, if you have operators. And finally, an interesting property. It's called Jacobi identity. And so that means you take bracket of three objects. So I take one Poisson bracket, and I stick it as a slot to another Poisson bracket. And then I do an even permutation of these things. So it means I'm shifting cyclically things around. It will be h, f, and g, and plus the last combination is g, h, and f. And surprise, it comes out to be zero. Okay, so this is called Jacobi identity. So again, what this means is, because of all these properties, is that it means that basically you have a Lie algebra. Okay. So again, this will be discussed by Gong next week, or maybe starting next week. So you have a Lie algebra. And in fact, what can happen is actually that you can define your Poisson brackets by all these properties. So you don't have to have this explicit expression here. So this is like a really prescription for your Poisson bracket. But you can start equally from saying, well, I have these properties 1 to 5. And then this will uniquely define what your Poisson bracket is. Okay, so properties 1 to 5. Define Poisson bracket if you want. Okay. So another note. Okay, so it's note. The Poisson brackets actually define your time evolution. So time evolution So the statement is, I want to calculate df over dt for any function on the phase space, and this will be given by the Poisson bracket f of a, this is my Hamiltonian, plus, if it happens, I have an explicit dependence of function f on time, and there's this extra term. It doesn't happen very often, so then your time evolution is really determined by the Poisson bracket only. And of course, the proof is very simple. It's very simple, so I really want to calculate what df over dt is. But it's a so important statement, then let me prove it. So it's df over dq, dqi, q dot I, then I have df over dp, pi dot, and then I have df over dt. Okay, so now I want to use my Hamilton's equations, which are somewhere here. So just plug whatever the pi dot is, which is dh over dqi, and whatever the qi dot is dh over dpi, right? So if you do it here, you get dh over dpi, and then you have dh over dqi. One of them has minus sign. And if you look at the definition of the Poisson bracket, it's precisely what you mean by that. So using the Hamilton's equations, this is precisely what you want. Final note. We talked about integrals of motion in the Lagrangian picture. So integral of motion. Well, it's usually so, you know, if your integral depends on time explicitly, it's very unlikely that it won't be conserved. So you forget about this ti over dt. And then, of course, you want something which doesn't change in time. So you won't require ti over dt equals to zero. This doesn't exist. That means the Poisson bracket equals to zero, right? So you define it by eh, ih equals to zero. And again, these things actually form an algebra, meaning that if I have two of them, i1 and i2, and you take their Poisson bracket, surprise, surprise, you get another integral of motion. Well, in fact, you get mostly zero, but in case you get something non-trivial, it's guaranteed it will be an integral of motion. And you will prove that in today's tutorial. Questions to Poisson brackets? So you may look at them at this point like a convenient tool to actually deal with Hamiltonian mechanics. So now in an interesting section, which is the canonical transformation, which is actually answering your question about the freedom of Hamiltonian mechanics. So canonical transformations. So who has seen those? Okay, so we are getting to waters which are not that well sailed. So definition. So basically, you were able to add, in the Lagrangian mechanics, you were able to add the total derivative of a function to Lagrangian and nothing changed. In the same way, you can actually choose arbitrary coordinates if you want to describe Lagrangian mechanics. So I can choose arbitrary generalized coordinates. As long as I have the right number of them, I'm fine. I should be fine, unless they are dependent and they are badly chosen. So basically you can do a change of coordinates and it's still okay. So here I can do it as well. So definition, and that's what canonical transformation is basically. Canonical transformation. Is a change of coordinates if you want. So I introduce, so I had my old coordinates were small q and p. Now I'll have big q and p. Qj, which is a function of my old ones, Qi, Pi, and T, and then big Pj, Qi, Pi, and T. call it QP. Okay. So this will be just a transformation. However, I tell you, it's a canonical transformation, so we require something more. So we require that it preserves the form of the Hamilton's equations. So what it means, actually, but I'm not saying that actually the Hamiltonian is preserved by these things. It doesn't have to be. But the form will be. So that means that there exists a function h prime, which will be my new Hamiltonian, h prime qj pj and t, such that the equations have the same form, dh prime over dpj, just the qj dot, and dh prime over dqj equals to minus pj dot. It's a definition of a canonical transformation. Okay. So it's not every transformation, but I still require that I can find such function h prime so that this is true. So just to show you that the worry is actually that you should be worried, not every transformation is canonical. So not every QP is canonical. So a stupid example, it's a really stupid example, but anyway. So free particle and you know that H is P square over 2M. And moreover, the example is even more stupid because it's not waterproof. But anyway, you just have to believe me. Or prove me wrong, that would be even better. So anyway, so I consider a system of a free particle, and my old coordinates are p square over 2m, so it's independent of q. And then I introduce new coordinates by, let's say, I'm taking a square root of q, and I just call big P the old p. Okay, and I'm asking, is this transformation a canonical transformation? So now, and as I said, it's not waterproof. So now I'm guessing, well, let's H doesn't change. Okay, so let's guess that H prime will be given by big P square over 2m. Okay, well, what else it can be? But, you know, it's just a guess. I haven't proved that choosing a different H, it wouldn't work. So anyway, so then dH prime over dp, big P, is p over m, which of course by our definition is small p over m. Okay, which is the original Hamiltonian over dp, which is in the original canonical transformation is small q dot. If I calculate what small q dot is, so q is small q is q square, so q dot is 2q q dot. Okay, so this equals to 2q q dot, right? But of course, if the transformation were canonical, I would require that this satisfies the canonical equations in new thing, so it should be equal to q dot, but it's not, right? So this transformation actually is not canonical. Nice, stupid example. So, but you know, it gives you something to worry about. So if I do some transformations, not all of them will be canonical. So how do I find those which are canonical? And I will tell you the secret. So these things are actually can be generated by functions. Okay, and the functions are called generating functions. That's a secret. So canonical transformations are generated by generating functions. We are going in a loop. Canonical transformations is something which is generated by generating transformation, and generating function is something which generates canonical transformations. Anyway. Generating functions what was it that a particle is something which particle detector detects, right? Okay, so generating functions, so what is it? So it's a function which is a function of set of old coordinates and set of new coordinates. Okay, so old can be Q and P. So I always choose one. So I have two options here, and new is big Q and P. So I have again two options times two options are actually four possibilities, right? So four possibilities. And so correspondingly, there are four types of generating functions, and these are related by Legendre transformation. So there'll be like F1 type and F2 type and F3 and F4, depending whatever I choose here. Okay, and these are related by Legendre transformation. So let me do the simplest example. I take F to be of my small q and of my big q and t. Sorry for that. And t. So now let's look at the Lagrangian freedom which we had in the description. Okay. So S was an integral of L, which is P Q dot minus H. And then I could add or subtract a total derivative, total time derivative of an arbitrary function. So let me subtract it, df over dt, dt. So this is my freedom. And the equations of motion will not change. Right? Okay, so what is this? So it's an integral. And let me collect the terms with q dot. So that will be p. So now again, I go through the painful. So df over dt is df over dq, q dot. Okay, it's minus df over dq. Right? And then I'll have term df over dp, p dot, okay? So function f is a function of q, q and t, okay? So it's df over dt is df over dq, q dot, and then df over the big q, q dot, okay? So it's minus df over dq, q dot, and then I still have my Hamiltonian, and f can be function of t as well. So I can have explicit time derivative of t, df over dt, dt. Different brackets. Okay, so this is what it is. So now I want to recast it in a new form, where this is a form of big P, u dot minus h prime. Okay, so what I want to do, so what I want now is to say that this has the form p q dot minus h prime p q and t dt. If I can do that, if I recast it in this form, then my Hamilton's equations will not change, because this is my action which gives this rise to the Hamilton's equations. Right? This is what I want. Okay. So how do I do it? Well, I just compare whatever stands, whatever I need to have with whatever I have. So first of all, you see that in this expression, there is no q dot. Right? So whatever stands in front of q dot must be zero. So this guy has to be zero. So I have a condition that so requirements. Are that p equals to df over dq. These are small, both of them. Then whatever stands in front of q dot must be p, right? So this must be minus p. So big p is minus df over d big q. And the last term must be my new Hamiltonian, right? And h prime equals to h plus df over dt. Let's call it c. So these are the conditions or requirements. But in other words, if you are given, you know, basically any nice function f, it gives me, which is function of q and big q, it gives me how, you know, I know everything. I know what is the new Hamiltonian. I know what is the new momenta. I knew everything. I know everything. So it really generates my transformation, if you want. Okay. So this gives q and p and h prime for given f. Of course, it may be possible that not every time you can solve these equations, and there are some integrability conditions of these equations. So there's extra conditions on this function f. Okay, but yeah, let's not be bothered about it. In fact, if these integrability conditions cannot be satisfied, you cannot find a function of this type. So we were trying to find a function of small q and big q, but sometimes it cannot be found. So then you may be searching for a function which is, for example, a function of small q and big p, okay, this f2, for example. And then, you know, then you may want to go to other generating functions. But if you are lucky and the system is nice, then you can find this simplest one. Yes?
Is the first requirement an extra condition on the function f that we can choose? The one with the little p and the little q?
Well, the integrability condition. Well, give me, for example, so you may want to be able to swap the derivatives, for example. I don't see it here. Yeah.
It acts as a constraint, right? Last ones, they are completely free. And you have to work with this. It has to be a constraint.
Yeah. So you really need all three equations to satisfy. And they give you these integrability conditions. Okay, so important remarks. So first remark is that basically Poisson brackets are invariant. Under canonical transformations. So that means that if I have Poisson bracket with respect to small q and p, then it takes the same value if I use big Q and P. Okay, so that's the statement. Or if you want, that will be your definition of canonical transformation as well. Okay. So in particular, if you have Q and P are new canonical coordinates, then you must get the same fundamental brackets PI, PJ. Okay. As I say, you can sort of define the canonical transformation by these properties. Okay, so that's boring. By the way, you can calculate these things using new coordinates, big Q and P, and then they are obvious. Or you can calculate them in terms of small Q and P, and then they give you the condition under which this is actually a canonical transformation. So really, then I have an equation, d big Q over d small Q, and d big P over d small P minus the other way around. And this you require is equal to 1, let's say. And this gives you extra conditions. OK. So now much more interesting property is that so far you were thinking about time evolution as something you are really doing to a system, something which is know, sort of invariant notion, and you know, time evolution is something really, really important and big. So now the statement is time evolution is just a canonical transformation. It's just a change of coordinates. Okay, so that's a big statement. So time evolution is just a change of coordinates. So let's be more precise. So time evolution is a canonical transformation generated by a special generating function. So who can guess what this function is? Almost. Something else? I haven't introduced that function. It's actually an action understood as a function by f equals to minus s. Okay. So that's a big statement. So it's almost Hamiltonian, but not really. So let me explain you what this s is actually. So S is the action, but now understood as a function. So S as a function of coordinates and time. Okay. So remember your action is given by an integral of L dt. And so far, we were understanding this as a functional of a trajectory. So for a given trajectory, so specifying Q, it gives me some number. Okay, so this was our understanding. So now what you do is that you say, I fixed my trajectory. I already know my trajectory. And then this actually, so this depends on T0 and Q0 and T and Q if you want. But if I fix my trajectory, this is already something concrete, which depends on time. So let's say I already fixed my straight line. And now I say, well, evaluate it, and calculate what it is on T0, Q0, and T and Q. It gives me something, right? So this is on shell, which means that the trajectory is fixed trajectory. And then it's just a function of whatever t0, q0, and t and q are, right? S, q0, t0, q and t. So basically, how we practically do it is that you have to solve your Euler-Lagrange equations. You have to find the trajectory. Once you have the trajectory, you actually calculate what Lagrangian is, right? And then use this integral and plug it in. And you understand it as a function of q0 and t0 and q and t. Okay. So I have already fixed my trajectory. And then question is, you know, q0 and t0 and q and t. If I start here and end here, it will be a different function. If I start here and there, it'll be another function. So, okay, so this is a change, you know, change of understanding what S is, right? So now it's a function of Q and T. Okay, so making this change, you can actually understand it even further as a function. So in particular, you can take DS. Okay, so we just differentiating the integral. So it's whatever is underneath that integral minus h dt, if you want. And the final thing, so at t minus pi dqi minus h dt at the initial. Okay, just taking a differential of an integral and evaluating at the at the upper bound minus whatever is in the lower thing, right? So by the way, what it means, if I don't care about initial, right? So let's say I fix initial things. I always fix q0 equal to something and t0 equal something. So let's say this is fixed just for the moment now. And then it will function only of q and t, right? So I'll be comparing all the time the same trajectory, the same q0 and t0, but we'll change q and t. So now I understand it only as a function of q and t. So then, obviously, so this is not important now. It's just some constant, right? So now this is a total differential, right? Which means that pi is actually ds over dqi. And h is ds over dt, right? So then ds over dqi is actually pi. And then ds over dt equals to minus h. OK, let's call it a triangle. Have you seen this? This is a Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Okay, Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And describes, again, classical mechanics in completely different language. We will discuss it on Monday. So, yes?
If the output is on the on-shell condition, right? Yeah. I think like, Q0 and Q is determined at a given time. So how can we say that it is function of Q, both Q and T? I think if we assign a T, and if we are certain that it is something, if it is solving the equation of motion, I think Q0 and Q can be found.
No. Okay, let's discuss this later. I'll try to clarify that. Okay, so I will not do the Hamilton-Jacobi equation now. But I'll do it on Monday. But let's return back to this function q and t time evolution. So what you want to find is q of t. And of course, this is a function q0, t0, q0, p0, t0. And t, and then p of t is a function of q0, p0, t0, t. Okay. So if I specify q0, p0, t0, and then at arbitrary time t, this is what you mean by solution, right? But now you look at this as q, new q and new p is a function of all q and all p. Okay? Okay, so this is just, if you want, a coordinate transformation. Okay. It's a coordinate transformation. But by the way, by integrating this, so integrating O back, what I'm getting is, so I put an integral on all sides. So I'll have this term and that term and that term. Let me just regroup that. So let me put the final on the left hand side. So I have p dq minus h dt equals to an integral p0 dq0 minus h dt, and then minus dt. Dt. Minus hdt. Okay, so it's just regrouping that thing, right? I just write ds as ds over dt, and then put it on the other side. Okay, so now, because you know that going from q0, p0 to q and p is a coordinate transformation, this is what I had before. Okay. Well, this is, and so this must be df over dt, my generating function, which proves that actually f is minus s, which is function of q, zero and q. It's a generating function. Okay, so really time evolution can be understood as a canonical transformation. Minus 15 minutes, oh no. Okay, and the final thing I want to discuss is, which completes basically the Hamiltonian description, is the Liouville's theorem. And that's something which is, again, very, very important for quantum mechanics once you start. And if you want, it's a consequence of quantum mechanics. But at a classical level, it means that the volume of the phase space is actually preserved under time evolution. So remark 3, or note 3, is the Liouville's theorem. It says that the volume of the phase space remains invariant under canonical transformations. Canonical transformations, or if you want, the phase flow time evolution preserves this volume. Okay, so illustration, let's say you have a head of a cat. You have a, so this is your phase space P and Q. And then you have a cat here. Okay, and this is my volume. My cat is the volume in the phase space at time t0 when the volume is v0. So then the statement is under time evolution. This cat actually will get squeezed and deformed, and it will be an ugly cat. Okay. So this is your cat now, after some time evolution. And this is the new volume which actually the cat has in your so vt. And the statement is, well, it can get deformed, but the volume doesn't change. So, okay, so proof in n equal to 1, it's very simple. So vt, so you know that the time evolution is just a canonical transformation. Okay, so vt is just an integral of my new coordinates, dq and dp. And of course, if I want to calculate it in terms of the old coordinates, I have to put the Jacobian there. Okay, so it's the Jacobian and dq and dp. Of course, dq and dp will be associated with t0 and v0 and dq and, okay, if you want qp, and this is qp. Okay, but what is the Jacobian? So Jacobian is just the determinant of dq over dq, dq over dp, dp over dq, and dp over dp. Okay, it's a 2x2 matrix, even I can calculate the determinant. It's this minus that. Okay, if you look at that and stare at that, it's just q and p in q and p, which is your Poisson bracket, which is equal to 1. So the Jacobian is equal to 1, which means this thing is actually equal to an integral dq and dp, which is, of course, v0. So that was the one-dimensional proof. More-dimensional proof is a little bit more technically complicated, but the same thing. But we will do it on Monday in a different fashion. Let me stop here.